Right. Isn't it just... Good morning. I am going to call the Commerce, Finance, Policy Committee meeting to order for Wednesday, April 15th, 2026. Hope everybody got their taxes done. There is a quorum present. Approval of the minutes from Thursday, April 9th. Can I get a motion to approve those minutes?
Madam Chair, I will move the minutes from the April 9th meeting.
Thank you. Chair O'Driscoll moves approval of the minutes for Thursday, April 9th, 2026. Any discussion to the motion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. First on the agenda today is House File 4881. So I will move that this is an informational hearing for the governor's supplemental budget. And so I would welcome Commissioner Arnold and Sam Smith from the Commerce Department. Please state your name for the records and proceed with your testimony. And if members haven't gotten coffee and donuts, go ahead.
That's an important part of any tax day is coffee and donuts. All right, so Chair Gagel and Chair O'Driscoll, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Grace Arnold, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and I'm here to testify on House File 4881, which is the department's supplemental budget bill, and I'll provide some background on the proposals. Our bill includes moving oversight of HMOs to the Department of Health from the Department of Health to the Department of Commerce, some policy changes governing non-depository institutions that's showing up in a budget bill because there's a very small amount of licensing impact that is a net zero on a spreadsheet, but is shows up on a spreadsheet. So technical changes related to the state's reinsurance program and a repeal of the Prescription Drug Advisory Council. So these are all budget neutral, and they reflect key department priorities for this session. So the first I'll cover is our HMO proposal. Health insurance continues to be more expensive and unnecessarily complicated for the everyday Minnesotan to navigate. It used to be said that an individual or a family without health care coverage was one accident or illness away from financial ruin. Now even those with coverage are facing insurmountable costs when someone becomes ill, at the very least, a confusing set of network restrictions, prior authorization requirements, just other general difficulties that make it hard to use the insurance that they do have. This is happening in an environment where insurance companies, particularly our small and local carriers, are under tremendous pressure. Lost premium tax credits, significant medical assistance and Medicare cuts, and other market dynamics continue to balloon costs. Minnesota is one of the only states in the country that doesn't regulate HMOs under a Department of Commerce or insurance. It's also the only state that does not have at least a divide of HMO oversight between what's the equivalent of the Department of Health and the Department of Commerce. This has led to confusion for consumers and insurers and diminishes the collective effectiveness in ensuring that we have a competitive insurance market and in supporting Minnesotans who have problems with their health insurance. Finally, it's not unrealistic to expect that Minnesota families shouldn't be shuffled between multiple agencies to get the support that they need in navigating the private insurance market. These market conditions have forced us to reflect on how the state regulates insurance markets, and we believe that changes are needed to ensure enhanced and aligned oversight of health insurance companies in Minnesota. So that's why we're proposing to transfer HMO oversight to the Department of Commerce. Having one agency responsible for regulating private health insurance that includes HMOs and non-HMOs will streamline, clarify, and enhance private insurance coverage oversight to create a more efficient and proactive regulatory structure. This creates a single place for Minnesotans to go if they need help with their private insurance coverage and lowers administrative and compliance complexity for insurers. Beyond the efficiencies to be gained by the consolidation, the department is also seeking a few enhancements to notification requirements when a health insurer experiences enrollment spikes, as well as controls governing executive compensation and bonuses when a health plan is no longer financially viable. This simplified regulatory structure will also remove barriers to consumers navigating the insurance system, and while there are subtle differences between HMO and non-HMO coverage, these distinctions are not transparent to consumers who often bounce back and forth between the Department of Health and Commerce when seeking support. Under this proposal, the Department of Commerce will become a one-stop shop for consumer complaints in the private insurance space. We expect to ease consumer confusion and improve our ability to enforce important priorities like mental health parity. I'll move on to our next area of work, which is the non-depository institutions article. This bill updates several statutes governing non-depository financial institutions to reflect modern lending practices. It clarifies the type of license that's needed for those who arrange consumer short-term loans. It removes unnecessarily dual licensure requirements for mortgage loan originators that are making junior lien loans and allows for sales finance companies to charge late fees when motor vehicle loans become delinquent. The bill also aligns the net worth standard for virtual currency licensees with accounting rules, removes outdated accreditation requirements for debt management providers, and closes a licensing loophole for entities that arrange payday loans. Finally, it requires lenders offering services online to display their licensing information and make several technical corrections to outdated statutory language. We're also making technical and date adjustments to the reinsurance program. I want to be clear, this isn't substantively changing the agreement that was reached last session. It's a narrow and targeted changes to just simplify the administration of that deal as we transition into an assessment-based financing mechanism. Finally, we're proposing to eliminate the prescription drug advisory council. This is not making a change to the Prescription Drug Affordability Board, but does that will remain in place. There are numerous opportunities for the public to participate in that in the Prescription Drug Affordability Board, and this is we expect that to be able to continue without the advisory council. With that, I would like to thank you for your time today. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. We will move to member discussion. Well, is there anybody from the public that would like to testify on this? No? Okay. We'll move to member discussion. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you. So I think from a consumer-facing point of view, this move makes sense. But as the commissioner knows, I never miss an opportunity to give Commerce a hard time about its analytic capabilities, not being up to the same level of Department of Health, which I think is kind of like the gold standard right now. So are they sending along their data and analytic capabilities along with this responsibility?
Commissioner.
Chair Cagle and Representative Elkins. So the analytic capabilities that are tied to statutory functions like the APCD will remain at the Department of Health. The analytic capabilities that we have, which I appreciate, have we have improved a lot. And if you want to have a conversation about that at some point, I'm happy to. There was, I think when I started, we had the lowest IT investment of any state agency. And so we've worked really hard to change that. But I appreciate that that's, you know, a distinction. So the analytic capabilities that we have that are specific to our financial analysis and actuarial work will remain. The analytic capability will be at Commerce. The analytic capabilities that exist as part of like the APCD will remain at Health. We envision that they'll talk to each other a lot, and so I imagine that, you know, I think we rely on the APCD and the work that that team does a lot now, just in overall health system understanding. We also have access to a lot of, like the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has a lot of analytic data. That a lot of it's non-public, so we can never share that. But that are those are very powerful tools that the health team doesn't have. They have some access to, but they will get more, like that will be a more enhanced access and ability to kind of tap into the national conversations, particularly around solvency and market conduct.
Yeah.
So for carriers that are operating in other states, we'll get more information.
Representative Elkins?
Yeah, thank you. And I'll during the interim, I will take you up on the offer for a visit.
Yeah,
thank
absolutely.
You.
Happy to.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Chair O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner, and Mr. Smith. Thank you for being here today. A couple of questions for you. I understand the desire to want to move the HMOs over, but I've I'm hearing from the health committees that they're not excited about the realignment on here. Commissioner or Mr. Smith, have you had conversations with, first of all, the Department of Health, second of all, with members of the chairs in the House about some of the concerns that I'm hearing that they may have relative to that move?
Yeah, so Chair Cagle and Chair O'Driscoll, great question. We have been talking a lot. This is a governor's budget proposal, so it's not like two agencies having different opinions about something. And I will say that the Department of Human Services is implicated as well, because there is shared work that supports the Medicaid managed care functions and making sure that there are solvent companies that are operating in the Medicaid program. So we've been in conversation with all of them. We have talked with the chairs. I think we've done our best to answer as many questions as we can and provide as much information as they need related to their concerns.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Arnold, in the proposal with the HMOs, in any way does it limit or control salaries as it relates to insolvency of the HMOs?
Commissioner?
Chair Cagle and Chair O'Driscoll, yes, so the proposal puts limits on executive compensation and bonuses in the case that a company is not doing well financially. So the theory there is you shouldn't be giving bonuses to executives if your company's failing.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Arnold. So what happens if a company is having difficulty, there's a change in management, and part of that is an incentive for a new executive team to come in and turn that around? Are we going to limit our options for people who use HMOs because we're going to place limits on compensation and trying to find the best talent to be able to help these organizations in a turnaround situation?
Commissioner?
Chair Cagle and Chair O'Driscoll. So we would have limits on the compensation. I think if there's, you know, desire to have some circumstances where there's a new leader coming in and recruitment is a challenge, we're happy to have that conversation. I'll say that the amount of, so that would be, you know, if that's something you want to talk about, happy to talk about it.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Arnold, I guess the concern that I have is not that I'm advocating that we limit salaries and the free market and things, but there are skill sets that people bring in all different professions. And I would surely hate to see a limitation on one's compensation as a result of a situation that they're in trying to turn around or have done what they're attempting to do to try to make that organization solvent and to level set that. I guess one of the biggest concerns that I have with the whole concept is I don't think it's the job of the government to regulate the salaries of persons in the insurance industry from this perspective, or for that matter, the healthcare industry. Getting broader but not getting off subject, in this very room last week, there were a number of committee hearings that were talking about one of the largest hospitals in Hennepin County that was having some difficulty, and I don't know that limiting the salaries of those individuals who are attempting to try to turn that organization around really makes sense. We're kind of discouraging the very best talent, and so I've got some real concerns about the HMO provision in here and how it might work, and I know we're laying this over, and Madam Chair, I know why we're laying it over, but maybe a little background for people why we're laying over the commissioner's the governor's financial bill and the reasons why and maybe what lies ahead for these kinds of provisions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Right now, the bill is in the possession of the Rules Committee. It was introduced after deadline. And so right now, we don't have possession of the bill. And so we are hearing it informationally right now. And it sounds like this might be rolled in with the Senate bill. And so we'll have to go from there. Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I know we're laying it over, but I want to make sure that I'm on the record with some concerns that I have about this bill, even though it's not in our possession. But I've been around here long enough to know that our paths are going to cross with these topics before May 17th again. So, again, just wanted to get on the record for the concerns that I have for our side of the aisle. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Commissioner. I think it was a little takes a little bit to digest some of the transition to the from health to commerce. I think we really do need to kind of look at that and see what steps we may need to take in the meantime, and how that we'd like to see how it's going to happen, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And so we will be talking more about it, I'm sure, And so if there is no further discussion, Commissioner Arnold?
Madam Chair, I just have one other comment.
Sure. Yeah, Chair Driscoll.
Commissioner, if you want to play Let's Make a Deal, I'm happy to take the CFB back and the HMO if that helps you.
Commissioner Arnold?
I'm here for efficient government, so this is a proposal that makes a government efficient just like the CFB was.
Thank you very much. So next on the agenda is, it's informational. So House File 4867, Representative Lee. I will move that House File 4867 before us with the intent to lay the bill over. Good morning, Representative Lee. Welcome to the committee. Would you like to present your bill?
Sure, thanks. So thank you, Chair Kegel and members of the Commerce Committee. It's good to be back before the committee to talk about a bipartisan way that we can all fight against fraud for our constituents. Last year, you helped create a restitution fund for people who have been found by a judge to have been frauded. This year, we're back with some fixes to make sure that the fund helps the most people possible. And I know we're short on time, so I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers, and we'll answer questions during Q&A. Thanks.
Welcome to the committee. I'm even not going to try. So if you would state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Jason Plegancool. I'm the manager of the Consumer Protection Division at the Attorney General's Office. The Attorney General's Office administers the Consumer Protection Restitution Account. Just a little update about our administration. To date, we have deposited over $4.5 million into the fund and are certainly on track to meet the fiscal year cap on deposits this year, this first fiscal year of its administration. We are currently in the process, as we speak, of making our first distributions to eligible consumers from the fund. These are consumers that were harmed by the closure of Woodbury Dental Association, which was a dental practice that suddenly closed, kind of leaving consumers in the lurch with large deposits and unfinished dental work. We've received over 320 claims from consumers and are in the process of sending out a first wave of payments to 76 approved claimants, totaling over $1 million in restitution. We support passage of House File 4867. It will improve our administration of the fund by two principal means. It will remove the fiscal year cap on deposits that currently exists of $5 million. It won't change the funding mechanism at all, but it will allow us to continue to deposit funds into the account each year without having to worry about meeting that limit. It also will set a fair restitution distribution formula for eligible consumers and that's going to allow us to distribute funds to as many eligible consumers as possible with the money that's in the account. Without this change, despite the fact that there might be hundreds of consumers waiting in line for restitution, consumers that have an outsized amount of loss threaten to exhaust the fund to the detriment of other consumers. And so just as an example, the Attorney General's Office, the top 10 individual scams from consumers that we've heard from have losses just from 10 individuals that exceed $6.5 million. And so under the existing structure of the fund, if we were to make distributions to those individuals, that would completely more than exhaust the existing fund for all consumers across the state. And so for that reason, we support passage and happy to answer any questions any members have.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Lois Shostek. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. It's Louise.
Oh, Louise, Shost. Sorry.
I'm close enough. And I live in the east side of St. Paul. Go ahead. Okay. My name is Louise Shostak, and I'm a constituent of Representative Liz Lee, who has been most helpful helping me with my situation. I sought dental help from Woodbury Dental Arts in December of 2023. They wouldn't start the work until I paid $25,000 fee upfront. So in January of 2024, I had all my teeth extracted and the hardware for the implants put in. After a few weeks of healing, I went back in February to start the process of getting my implants. On March 5th, I was having my supper and a WCCO came on with a report of Woodbury Dental Arts abruptly closing their doors, leaving their patients high and dry. Needless to say, I was shocked and upset. My brother, who was here with me today, drove out there the next day with a sign. They had a sign on the door about closing and no further information. This has been a nightmare for me, not to mention the money I lost. I had to start over with another dentist who is wonderful. I now have new teeth, but in some ways is still not what I expected. I'm still unable to chew and eat certain foods, but thankful for what I have compared to the day the clinic closed. I had to pay all over again and am hoping to be reimbursed a lot of what I lost, and that is why I'm here today. This bill is very important to make sure there will be enough funds for many fraud victims like me who lost money to fraud for many years to come. Please support Representative Lee's bill. Thank you for listening to my story and helping fraud victims.
Thank you very much. Next up is Thomas Elnis. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Cagle, Chair O'Driscoll, and members. My name is Thomas Elnis. I serve as the Associate State Director of Advocacy with AARP Minnesota. I want to echo all of the comments of the previous speakers and thank you and the entire legislature for leading the nation last year in creating a consumer fraud restitution fund and helping victims like Louise and so many others. For the reasons that have already been stated, we support the bill. We think it's a good cleanup, really, of what we started last year, and would ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lee, I see that the bill, if I am reading this correctly, allows more dollars to flow into the restitution account, which good. I'm glad to see that. I am wondering, though, we do have cases that were mentioned in testimony that exceed $50,000. If there's more dollars flowing in, is there a way to address some of those larger claims over time rather than just simply capping the amount at $50,000?
Representative Lee?
Yes, thank you, Chair. So this proration question is a good question. I've been talking to your constituent, Representative Heinzman, and so understand the, you know, just the distress that people go through when they've been frauded. I think this is, you know, open for discussion. When we started the fund, it was unclear how much would come in every year. I do think that it is important to make sure that we help people in an equitable way, and so that this is our starting position. $50,000 is the total compensation is actually possibly $100,000. $50,000 is just what you would be restituted up to 100%, and so any claim. I think there's the sheet from AARP that kind of shows you or gives an example of how claims would be reimbursed under this proposal. It's to make sure that, you know, if you've lost $2 million, that you don't exhaust the fund, but also understand that the way the bill is written right now, it's annual deposits, and, you know, there would be a line of people. And so this new structure helps the Attorney General's office make sure that we reimburse folks as much as possible.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up, Representative Lee. So I'm not sure if I heard that there'd be a willingness to make an adjustment, or if there is not, I know that it's not just more than my constituent that's affected by this. And I hope that to give this bill a better shot, that there might be interest in making an adjustment that over time, individuals who have suffered a loss greater than the limits in your bill could potentially be made whole as more dollars come into the account. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick question, maybe it's the AGs that can answer this, and it kind of just applies to when you're going after individuals or companies that do this. Do the companies, can you touch their A&G, their errors and omission insurance for some of this stuff? I mean, it's fraud, but does that not apply? I'm just, what I'm hearing in retrospect is many of these places get out of your reach. They leave the country, whatever. And so you have somebody with a zero assets to, can you go after if they had E&O insurance at one time?
Mr. Plagenkuhl?
Yeah, so we would try to exhaust all collection efforts against someone we obtain a judgment from. So the answer would be yes. We would do our best to try. And what the fund does is it doesn't foreclose us continuing to pursue collection efforts against a judgment and anything that we pay out of the fund, but then subsequently do collect from the defendant would be reimbursed to the fund. So it doesn't foreclose our ability to attempt to collect from defendants, but sometimes that's very difficult or impossible.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that answer. Now the other thing, I don't know if anybody here can answer it. Are these funds, once they're returned to the victim, are they taxed or are they considered a settlement and they are not taxed?
Representative Lee.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Yes, well, because Chair Rest is the Senate co-lead, we actually made sure to put in a provision to make this not taxable because you've already been taxed when you get your money. So.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other members? Seeing none, thank you so much. Representative Lee, any final thoughts to the bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair. So, yeah, again, thank you for helping create the Fraud Restitution Fund in the first place. I would reiterate this is a starting position to make sure that the funds are distributed to as many people as possible. And so removing the cap is really important. We can talk about the details of the proration as this bill moves forward to May 17th. So thanks.
Thank you. With that, Representative Lee, thank you. And I move that House File 4867 be laid over. The bill is laid over. All right. Next up, Representative Elkins. If you would like to move your bill.
Yes, Madam Chair. Our intention this morning is to move this bill along to Ways and Means.
Correct.
Got a big price tag, and final amount will be determined above my pay grade.
Mine too.
And there is an author's amendment.
All right. Would you like to move the A1 author's amendment?
I would like to move the A1 author's amendment. This is a requested clarification, some new language requested by the Commerce Department.
Thank you. Any discussion to the language? All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
All right, to your bill, Representative Elkins. Yep.
So at the beginning of the session, we had an informational hearing here to talk about the property insurance task force that I chaired during the interim. And one of the biggest recommendations out of that was that we take an existing program that the legislature passed in 2023 called Strengthening Our Homes, which basically provides as a program where homeowners who strengthen their roof to fortify standards to withstand wind and hail damage, get a break on their property insurance. Okay, but the bill in 2023 was passed so late in the session that it was too late to appropriate any money, to serious money, to get it fully implemented, and or allow the department to really fully staff up to implement it as well. So really all we're doing here is basically appropriating the money to get this going, this program going seriously.
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. We do have some testifiers up on the agenda. First up is Dr. Julie Nierbon, followed by Elsie Shapak. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Excellent. Thank you. Madam Chair, Chair, and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this file, 4223, adding funding for Strengthening Minnesota Homes Program. My name is Julia Nierbon, and I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light. And our organization is partnering with faith and spiritual communities across the state who are committed to taking meaningful action to address the climate crisis. Part of that crisis is increasingly connected to people's struggle with the impacts of extreme weather. We believe that adding funding to the Strengthen Minnesota Homes program and helping homeowners strengthen their homes is a crucial step towards mitigating the random, unpredictable, and increasingly common disasters facing many Minnesotans today. From wildfires to ice storms to extreme winds and deep freezes, Minnesota residents are seeing it all, and they are calling for help. Last year, our organization conducted community forums in Morris, Alexandria, Woodbury, St. Peter, Duluth, and Winona. And we heard from over 140 people, including emergency managers and mayors, council members, county commissioners, business owners, farmers. And they all expressed serious concerns regarding the increasing severity of the of the storms that they were experiencing. They mentioned the financial burden of repair expenses, and many people highlighted the rising cost of insurance and the diminishing coverage and the inflated construction, labor, and material costs following these widespread disasters. We heard from one farmer who had to replace his roof four times in 20 years. So what's going on there? Clearly not putting on a good roof. We need him to have a fortified roof. Others reported having to tarp their roofs through the winter because they couldn't secure the timely assessments and the construction needed to keep their home safe. Nobody wants to endure this disruption and the pain of having your home damaged by extreme weather. And while many residents were unfamiliar with the Fortify Roof Standard and other similar programs, they were very eager to learn more about them. They wanted to be able to enhance their buildings so that it could withstand the impact of this extreme weather. They're actively looking for information and community response mechanisms. By funding this program, we can close the gap between a conventional and a fortified roof for lower-income Minnesotans. This will make a substantial difference in closing the vulnerability gap, but it will also spur the roofing industry to actually make the changes they need to provide fortified roofs as business as usual. So we anticipate that if we can fund this program, we'll see many, many times the impact in terms of weatherizing Minnesota. So please support HF 4223 to provide additional programs for this essential program.
Thank you very much. Next up, Elsie Shulpak. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's okay. Good morning. My name is Elise Shupak. I'm a policy advocate with the consumer advocacy organization Public Citizen. I'm testifying in support of HF 4223. The rise of severe convective storms in Minnesota, with an estimated 1.8 million homes in the state at risk of hail damage, makes widespread roof fortification in the state essential. Public Citizen supports the appropriation from the state's general fund for the program this year, though going forward encourages the committee to pursue stable and ongoing program funding from the insurance industry. Alabama, Oklahoma, and Maine, among other states, already fund roof fortification programs with fees on the insurance industry. In program implementation, the Department of Commerce should prioritize making grants accessible to low and moderate income homeowners who do not have the ability to make upfront investments in climate resilience, but would benefit most from reductions in climate damages and costs over the long term. We support the provision in this bill to prioritize homeowners whose household income is at or below 115% of AMI, but the department should consider other measures, including larger grant sizes and low-cost financing options for costs not covered by the grant for those households as well. Public Citizen urges the committee to support funding for the Strengthen Minnesota Homes program. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then next up, Drew Govezzi. I'm sorry. I'm just not getting anybody right today.
No, I'm good. Thank you. Thank you. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Drew Govezzi, and I'm the Advocacy Director with Habitat for Humanity of Minnesota, the statewide support organization for the 24 habitats across the state. I'm also here today representing the Minnesota Consortium of Community Developers. We strongly support House File 4223 to provide funding for the Strengthen Homes Minnesota program. Across our network, we regularly hear that insurance premiums are rising rapidly, often doubling or tripling, making it harder for families to sustain homeownership over time. We appreciate the bill's prioritization of households at or below 115% AMI and encourage continued focus on ensuring these resources reach lower-income homeowners. For many families, resilience upgrades like fortified roofs are out of reach without this kind of support, but it's really essential for long-term affordability, stability, and the opportunity to build generational stability and wealth. Habitat's homeownership model is centered on long-term affordability and resilience, and we believe this program can be a key tool in advancing both of these. We would like to see the program expanded to support new construction as well, as opposed to just rehabs. In fact, our Habitat affiliate in Winona has already built 5 homes using this IBHS fortified standard, and Habitat Minnesota has staff with certification as a certified fortified home evaluator. Habitat and our peers stand ready to serve as a continued partner with the state to help strengthen more Minnesota homes through this program. Thank you, Representative Alkins and committee members, for the opportunity to testify. Together we can build a stronger homes for Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me, a couple questions I have is, what other states have implemented this program? And have the insurance companies been, I'm curious what the insurance companies are going to do for their rates once this program is implemented, and if somebody, and my concern is that it affects everybody's rate eventually. So can you give a little clarity to that?
Sure. We talked about this quite a bit, Chairman. In the task force, the insurance industry is supportive of the program. Alabama was the first state to do this, and they had occasion to test it, you know, fairly early on. They get a lot of hurricanes and tornadoes. And so the first study of this type of a program was from Alabama, and it was shown in their study to be very cost effective. So the standard we would use here would be a little bit different. We don't have hurricanes and tornadoes, so we want to, you know, fine-tune what constitutes a fortified roof here, so that it's mostly focused on hail and straight-line winds, which are our biggest issues. But the research to date in the states, I think Oklahoma has also passed one as well. Their biggest problem is tornadoes, but in every state so far that has done this, it has proven cost effective.
And I see we have Mr. Cocking, if you'd like
there
to
we go.
State
I got
your
the
name
head nod from the chair, so I came, I came to the table. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Cocking, I'm the president and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. We represent the state's property casualty industry. And to echo Chair Elkins, yeah, we are supportive of the fortified program, building to a fortified standard and finding a way to address the damage we're seeing from severe convective storms, from the wind and hail, is paramount. As Chair Elkins talked about, as Representative Elkins talked about, we have seen, obviously, everybody that's opened their insurance premiums and knows the impact that we're all paying as a result of these storms. The fortified standard actually comes about from the Institute for Business and Home Safety, which is an industry-funded group that is working to figure out how do we build to a standard that's able to withstand
stronger winds, larger hail, so that, you know, you look at the roofs that go on and the roofs that we are throwing in landfills, I think is an environmental issue as well. And so until we can kind of get our hands around, you know, we're not, I've said for a long time, you know, we don't have a switch to control the weather. So how do we deal and how do we build in a way that allows us to kind of handle the weather that we are, the changing weather that we are getting?
Representative Van Binsbergen. Thank you.
I would add that I had a constituent who did this on his own and discovered that with the discount he got on his homeowner's insurance, the project paid for itself in like 7 years.
Yeah. And I really want to thank Mr. Cocking, too. You know, a few years back, I had the Sustainable Infrastructure Committee, and, you know, we talked about this all the way back then. You know, we really need to start fortifying our buildings so that we don't have to file a claim every 4 years, every 5 years. And we went through that, too, with my house. We had two roofs in, I think it was like 3 years. And so just thinking about all that asphalt sitting in the landfills, and you know, if we have less claims, our rates will hopefully go down. And I really wish that we could move forward with that infrastructure council, because it's not just homes that need to be fortified, it's our entire infrastructure, it's our wastewater, it's our stormwater, it's, you know, drinking, buildings, roads, everything needs to really be fortified at this point. And so I really hope we can move forward with that someday.
Can I add one thing, Madam Chair? The one thing that I would also say about the bill as drafted, though, is I think we probably should look at the 115% number and the availability of how we're getting these grants out. I mean, I think there's a value in broadening this to get more people, because I think from our standpoint, the perspective is if we can get more people to do this, you kind of get the word of mouth that starts to spread, and you get other people that start to do it. Hey, I see you had this roof put on. It looks a little different. Oh, yeah, I have a fortified roof. My insurance is giving me a discount. And I just feel like limiting it to that 115% maybe doesn't capture enough of the population of Minnesota to really get that number going. So I think it's something that we should probably take a look at as well.
Representative Heitzman? Oh, did you have a follow-up, Representative Van Binsbergen?
Sure. Well, I guess my comment is, yeah, you maybe want to extend it to everybody. And at what cost is that to the taxpayer? And how do we know $35 million is going to do the trick here?
I don't think we do. I think that's a placeholder amount, Madam Chair. So like I said, this will get determined in ways and means.
And Mr. Cocking?
Yeah, and to that point, Representative Van Binsbergen, I don't think you're necessarily wrong. I mean, at some point there's a trade-off, but I do think that at some point, you know, you get enough momentum, and there's going to end up being a savings at some point. I mean, and I know that's tricky, and we talked round and round in the task force about the number and what it should be and how it should go. But at some point, you got to put enough into it where you get a recognition that there's a value to this, and so the ball starts rolling, and other people start picking it up without the grants. I mean, I don't think these grants should live on forever, but to get them started and to get people taking them up, I think would be important.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have similar thoughts to Representative Van Binsbergen. I'll just take it a little bit different way. Representative Elkins, you know, you're kind of giving me an idea, mm-hmm. because we certainly want people to understand that if they build with stronger materials, mm-hmm. that there's an advantage in the long run. You're not just potentially resistant to hail, you know, also fire, you know, for those of us that are out in the woods. Mm-hmm. If you're building with steel, you have less likelihood of those kinds of things happening if there were embers or what have you falling. The approach, though, that I'm curious about, and if the task force addresses, I'd like to know. And it sounds like your testifier or the testifier the chair brought to the desk might have some knowledge of that if that was covered, because I think a tax incentive might be a benefit that could far exceed a $40 million cap on a program that, I mean, we say it's on the insurance companies, but I mean, let's be honest, that's not how it works. It's going to impact ratepayers.
Yep.
And so an alternative answer you know, maybe not this bill, maybe another idea that could get at finding the solution would be incentivizing people to build with products that are resistant to these things. And if that could be addressed, that'd be great.
Mr. Cocking?
Madam Chair, Representative Heintzman, yes, and actually, you know, the focus of the fortified standard as far as roofs go in Minnesota was really targeted because that's the biggest exposure we have. But the IBHS has put a number of other standards forward, too, that have been picked up. Their broader standards generally deal in more coastal areas that deal with the hurricane exposure. But recently, they've adopted a number of fortified, I think it's fortified fire. Don't hold me to that. That's the technical thing, but that's the intent. For more of the western states that have been dealing a lot more with the wildfires that we've seen. And so that science is available on how to build and offering some type of tax incentive for the people like in your district and further north that probably face more of a fire exposure via tax incentive and doing that, I think is certainly worthwhile to look at.
And I see we have another testifier up there. Would you like to address that as well? Or?
Thank you, Chair Cagle. I would like to speak more towards the previous question,
Okay, maybe if I could finish my thought,
yep,
Madam
Chair. Sure, Chair. Representative Heintzman.
Okay, thank you. I think that those of us that, you know, have looked at this kind of a problem, you know, and I'll just use myself as the example, Madam Chair. I've chosen to replace all the roofs on my property with significantly stronger materials so that I personally can avoid this and I can see a reduction in my insurance costs. And I think that if we could, to my earlier point, incentivize people that if you buy these products, you know, some of the costs could be reduced if there was, and it sounds like part of what the task force looked at was tax incentives. So, you know, even if this bill doesn't move forward, I think that would be a real good tool to help people to, you know, do like we've done with insulating their homes and increasing the efficiency of their home, buying new windows. You know, that's a significant expense. There's tax breaks for that. So that would be the idea, you know, that I think that Representative Elkins, you're kind of probably spooling up in a lot of our minds. As we talk about, you know, this bill, there may be something else that comes along that could address the issue, and I think that I'd like to join in that effort. So, Mr. Cocking, if you had more on that maybe we haven't yet covered, go ahead. Otherwise, Madam Chair, that was my comment.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. Mr. Cocking?
Just briefly, I mean, I think we echo that. I mean, that's been one of the priorities of our organization. I mean, especially on the fortified stuff. I mean, if you move to, you know, sales tax exemption on roofs to a better standard or something along those lines, I mean, I think there's novel ideas out there. I mean, to find a way to do this where people have an incentive to want to do that. I mean, we've long said, you know, it'd be nice at the beginning of, you know, early construction and people are building new homes that instead of doing the, you know, the finer upgrades, the granite countertops, they're putting on fortified, that there's probably more of a benefit to that, but that's hard for people to get their heads around because, you know, they see the granite and touch the granite countertops on a daily basis, but they only notice their roof when they've got hail damage, and suddenly it's like, oh, you had hail, you had roof that wasn't able to withstand the weather that we see in Minnesota. So,
yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Elkins.
I think generally, to your point, that consumers are becoming more aware, becoming much more likely now to take the total cost of ownership of a home into account in their purchasing decisions as well. You know, historically most of the function was just on, you know, what is the interest rate on my loan, but we're running into situations, especially in places like Florida, where people can afford the mortgage, but they can't afford the homeowner's insurance, and home sales are actually falling through because they once the prospective buyer understands how much the homeowner's insurance is going to cost them, they realize they can't afford it. I think the same thing holds true with home energy standards. It's not necessarily you know, really visible, but when it comes down to housing affordability, you have to count, you know, the purchase price, the financing price, the home energy consumption, and the liability, the insurance coverage all go into the total cost of ownership of a home that has to be considered.
Thank you. And as we call it, maintenance and operation.
Yeah.
Representative Davids.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And you're exactly right. The comment you made about insurance rates going down if more people would have fortified roof siding and so forth. Mr. Cocking, what is kind of like the average discount someone would get? I have a house, let's say X number of dollars, my premium is $2,000. What kind of discount would I get if I did the fortified construction?
Yes,
Mr. Cocking.
Madam Chair, Representative David's very timely question. So over the course of the last year, the Minnesota Department of Commerce had done a data call on the industry trying to get data because they were, as a result of the law that was passed in the setting up the fortified program that required an insurance company to offer a discount to people that had built to the standard. They were trying, and I see Peter Brickwitty from the departments here, if he can correct me if I'm wrong, but trying to figure out a range that would work so that when those filings come in, they had gone through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners to try to determine, you know, what's the number that we should be looking at. And I think it was like 35 to 42% is roughly the number that they're expecting for that discount for people who build to that fortified standard.
And we did get a affirmative head nod from Mr. Brickwitty.
Okay. Hey. All right.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Elkins, I want to kind of understand, you mentioned something about income limits. How do those apply? And are you going to have the lower income folks that want to put these fortified roofs on and there's no way they can afford them? Are we really limiting who can get these fortified roofs?
Representative Wilkins.
Yeah, joining me at the table is Carrie Johnson, who is a member of our task force, and this is a question that she would like to address
good.
Herself, actually.
Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah, thank you so much, Chair Cagle. Carrie Johnson, I'm the Director of State Policy and Field Building at the Minnesota Consortium of Community Developers, and worked with Representative Elkins and Mr. Cocking on the task force over the fall and into the beginning of this year. And we, work with Chair Elkins to bring forth this bill for the funding request because it's something our members are very, very much interested in, as you heard from Habitat Minnesota. One of the things that we want to see is to make sure that lower-income households, 115% AMI is actually a Minnesota housing building standard for affordable housing. So it's not as low as you would think, especially in greater Minnesota. But there is an opportunity also to pair this funding with Minnesota housing dollars, as potentially we could expand it to new construction or rehab dollars as well. Mm-hmm. And so just wanted to... it's a preference, it's not a requirement to consider lower income households. So if you have 100 people that apply and 15 of them meet that 115% area median income, they would be given preference. But if you have enough to fund 100 homes, everybody else would also get that incentive as well.
And thank you, Madam Chair.
I've
got kind of an oxymoron here where you say affordable housing, but you're going to spend all this money on fortified roofs. The two don't. It doesn't make housing affordable. It makes it safer. It makes it for less insurance costs, but it doesn't make it cheaper.
Well, thank you.
And I'm really cheap.
Chair Cagle, Representative Davids, affordable housing is meant to be affordable for the people living in the homes. It's not necessarily always affordable to build. It's meant to help support generational wealth building opportunities for individuals. And to Chair Elkins' point also, we want to provide opportunities for people to stay in their homes and be in their homes. And if they cannot do that or take advantage of things like the down payment assistance program that the legislature passed, because their insurance premiums are, higher than anticipated or becoming higher than initially planned out or budgeted for, they can no longer participate. So we want to make sure lower income households can also see the benefit of this. And lower income households, 115% area median income, I want to say in the metro is something like $75,000 annually, and then in greater Minnesota it's like $60,000. So for a household of four.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Elkins, I've got a client in Rice County and Representative Allen's district who put on a fortified roof, and after what they had two nights ago, it's not so fortified. It's gone.
But Representative Elkins.
Representative
Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
No, I think in terms of affordability, you know, the cost of property insurance is actually at this point threatening the viability of many nonprofit housing developers. Their projects just aren't penciling out right now. We're on the verge of actually losing affordable housing just because the cost of property insurance is just making their projects not pencil out anymore.
Madam Chair, can I just respond real quickly to the Representative David's point?
Mr. Cocking?
I don't want the notion to be that the fortified homes are indestructible homes. They're built to a standard to withstand, but when we get softball-sized hail like they had in Faribault, I mean, there's nothing that you're going to put on that's going to be able to withstand that. It's the reason that you get a discount of 35 to 42% and not 100%, because there is still a risk exposure because we in Minnesota see that type of hail more frequently than we would like.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I just had one question. So by putting a you can tell me yes or no. So by putting a fortified roof on a, let's say like a $300,000 home, that does that add equity to the house? Yes. Mr. Cocking?
Madam Chair, I would say, maybe the realtors can come up. I see Paul, but I'm not. I'm guessing. I would suggest. I mean, I think that there's a value to it. I mean, it is a product that is going to reduce. I mean, there is a value in having that. I couldn't tell you what that number is, but I seriously think that's probably
okay.
True.
Representative Elkins.
Well, I think Representative Hewitt.
Oh, hey, there you go, Representative Hewitt.
I might know the answer to this.
Maybe.
Madam Chair, and yes, when you look at pricing a house for sale, when you look at improvements that are going to help reduce insurance or reduce cost in the long run, it is definitely a more sellable and sometimes increases the price somewhat. But overall, we're still having insurance as a pool, right? So you're going to have these ongoing concerns about the pool and, I was listening to Chair Davids there a little bit, and I think it's going to cost you more. It's definitely going to be that you're not going to file claims, but it doesn't mean your neighbor's not going to file claims. So it helps a little. So,
Madam Chair, I would add to that. This is a topic that I've devoted some time to understanding and speaking with the realtors about. And I think that it clearly, when you get to where we are with like Florida, then yeah, it's top of mind for home buyers. But generally, I think that we could do a better job with both programs like this or with home energy improvements if we were presenting more relevant information to home buyers in the listings.
Thank you. So I see it as kind of like a we're building equity in the housing while lowering insurance rates, so kind of improving the maintenance and operation of the house. And so I hope that would transfer to, all the ratepayers. Representative Van Binsberg, and man, I've been so good today, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess going back to, the $35 million appropriation, can you tell me a little bit about the process? Because I imagine they're going to be beating down the door to access funds, people. And how did you come to this number of the $35 million determination or whatever our number is here?
See Mr. Brickwoody coming to the table, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
I mean, I don't think there's anything magic about this number, but as Mr. Cocking explained, we're trying to jumpstart the program. We need enough money to gain the public's attention to this, and hopefully we begin a bandwagon effect, and in the long term that we won't need any subsidy at all, but we needed a meaningful enough number to capture the public's attention.
Mr. Brickwoody?
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwoody from the Department of Commerce, Representative Van Binsberg. And to your earlier question, there are more than a dozen states that have similar grant programs. We were the first northern and cold weather state in the country to pass a program. The most mature programs in the country are in Gulf Coast states. The state of Alabama was mentioned earlier. They have the oldest and largest program to date. They've issued somewhere in the neighborhood of 8,000 to 9,000 grants in the lifespan of their program, but there are now over I think about 60,000 fortified roofs in the state of Alabama. So only about 17% of the total fortified roofs are in that state are the result of grants from the state. And I would agree with Mr. Cocking's earlier comments. I think what success looks like for a state in this space is the grants provide an opportunity to create economic stimulus and create the economic environment, plus the workforce that you need to be able to put fortified roofs on homes across the state. That's where you're going to get maximum effect on rates overall. I would just note that in parallel to this proposal, separately, in 2023, the legislature did require insurance companies to provide that premium discount or rate reduction that Mr. Cocking was speaking to earlier. So there is real significant value to policyholders who put a fortified roof on their home with or without a grant. And if we can do that at scale, we should see also positive rate reduction or rate impacts, I should say, for all consumers across the state.
Thank you. And just one last question. So for Mr. Cocking, so if I have somebody that is above the income threshold, they can expect a 35 to 42% deduction if they put on this type of roof on their premium as well?
Mr. Cocking?
Madam Chair, Representative Binsbergen, let me clarify my earlier point. The number that I gave, the 35 to 42%, is what the Department of Commerce came up with as far as their numbers and running them all, as far as what they will, and I'll use common jargon, kind of automatically accept when an insurer files a rate discount under this program. The law also gives insurers the ability to file their own actuarial numbers on what they come back with. And I think the problem that we've had a little bit as an industry is that there aren't enough of these fortified homes in the market yet to be able to make a real actuarial determination. As Mr. Brickwitty mentioned, all of the other states that have done this so far are not our Gulf Coast states or not northern states, and the exposures we face here, this is a long-winded way of getting to say not necessarily. It depends on the carrier, but there will be a reduction, especially as you get more to it. And I'm looking forward to, as we get more fortified homes, to be able to plug that in to see what those actuarial numbers actually look like to see. Because as Representative Davids mentioned, it's not a zero, because there's still going to be softball-sized hail that falls in the state.
And Mr. Brookwood, did you have something to add?
Madam Chair, I'd agree with Mr. Cocking. Just a couple of clarifications. That expected discount amount is for an individual home that would put a fortified roof on. So that's a fortified roof discount. I think what we've seen in the other states that have larger programs and have more fortified roofs is not just insurance pricing reduction, but also improvements in availability and carriers willing and interested in selling in those markets. Take Alabama and Florida, next door neighbors, similar types of hurricane risk exposure. The steps that Alabama has taken through the Strength in Alabama Homes program, adding fortified roofs and investing in mitigation, have really strengthened that market. And you see carriers going into that market where we've seen difficulty in the Florida market because we haven't had those types of investments. Florida then followed Alabama and is now investing heavily in more fortified roofs in that state as well.
Yeah, we need to develop a critical mass of contractors who know how to do it.
Thank you. All right. Representative Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a couple of comments, and I have a few follow-ups for probably Mr. Brickwitty and also Mr. Cocking. We have, since I've been here, and particularly in the last number of years, as we've seen, the number one claim, and Mr. Cocking, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that homeowners or that property casualty companies are seeing right now, roof and siding damage, right? And it's not just, you know, once every 30 years. It's almost like, well, every 10 years somebody's getting a new roof or new siding. Mm-hmm. Those are cost drivers. And to the point of the discussion that we have here, to re-shingle or to re-roof a home that wasn't strengthened or fortified, the cost to doing that is marginal. When you figure the bundle of shingles that you're looking at, there are different codes and factors out there in the industry. If you look at the codes for the fortified shingles and you talk to your insurance company about that, and they line that up on the list of approved shingles, for about $600-$700 on a standard roof, maybe a little more, you can fortify that and you can immediately experience the savings that we're talking about from the insurance companies in the private sector without any government regulation on this. And That's I think, is a very positive step that the insurance company has taken and the work that they're doing. Number two thing that we've done, and Mr. Cocking, I know you're chomping at the bit here, but I also want to get this on the record. A few years back, I was instrumental in helping to get introduced into the Commerce Bill a provision that said when damage happens, a contractor can't just come in, have you sign a contract for services without an estimate of what the costs are going to be. And I'm very excited about the fact that the task force work is starting to make its way to the commission and to the committee right now. And that is one of the things that's a cost driver as well, is when you have someone who's not licensed as a public adjuster to step into the market to help consumers on that, it's like going to a doctor who's not a doctor and hoping for the best. And I'm not maligning the construction. They do their job, and many of them do it very well. But the issue becomes, sometimes it's like, well, what's it going to cost? Well, how much is the policy limits?
Yep.
Gosh, we're just about $1,000 within the realm of the policy limits. That's not how this should be done. This should be done in a way where the insurance company assesses the damage. Mr. Cocking, I'm certainly going to give you a chance to respond to that, but one question I have for you on this is, since we don't allow, quote unquote, the contractor to be the public adjuster, because that's not their job, they're not licensed to that, in an environment like that, if someone were to retain a public adjuster as a consumer, how does that person or party get paid, and what does it do to the settlement, if you will, to be able to do a fortified roof or to do siding on a property?
Mr. Cocking?
Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, let me make one point before I get to your question on the public adjusters on your fortified roof. And I want to emphasize it's fortified roofs, not fortified shingles, because there are a few other elements, not to necessarily nerd out on this, but the way that they wrap the eaves and they do some of that other stuff, it so there's a little bit more to it than just the shingles, and I just wanted to note that because I think that's important. As far as public adjusters go, generally the public adjusters are taking 20% of whatever the value of the settlement is. I think that you can make an argument that public adjusters play an important role for people. I mean, I think that there's times where it's abused. I've seen instances in which insurers are paying full policy limits on a total loss. I had an insurer tell me a story. They had a full $700,000 house that was a total loss. They had gone out. The insured had already hired a public adjuster. They wrote them a full check for $700,000 3 days later, and the public adjuster, having done no work, took 20% of that. I mean, if you think that's fair, I would question that, but I know that a lot of times we're going to portray these guys as the white hats, and I think there's a value to them, but that's not always the case.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Cocking, that creates another affordability issue, right? So if the claim for the roof is $50,000 and 20% of that is $7,500, plus RC deductible, and thankfully we also put in the law that says you can't roll your deductible into the cost of what the contractor is going to charge. A deductible is your out-of-pocket commitment to that in risk management as the consumer. So what happens is you've got a check for roughly, $42,500, but you've got a bill of $50,000. How does someone be able to bridge that gap and to deal with that? So some of the alternative methods that are out there certainly can cost the consumer and can also cost more in the insurance realm that we're looking at. And I think that's very important to get on the record this morning when we're having this discussion as well.
Mr. Cocking?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I would completely agree with that. I mean, I think that insurers and just the number of losses that we pay, knowing what the cost of a bundle of a square of shingles is, I mean, are pinpointed on this and know that they want to, I mean, despite a lot of what we hear, I mean, insurers know that and they want to pay because they want to make these folks whole. I would argue that public adjusters have an incentive to get that number up higher because they've got their 20% to cover, and then not leave the, no policyholder wants to be there and be like, well, I hired you and I'm still out of pocket this. I mean, it could have had this for what the insurer offered. And I think that's one of the challenges when we look at all of this stuff is, who's at the trough and what are they taking from what should go to the policyholder. I mean, recognizing they represent the industry, I mean, I know full well that they are working to make sure that these policyholders are made whole. They don't have an incentive otherwise, despite what others might think. But that's just not the function of an insurer is to make their policyholder whole, and they do that with, I think, incredible results.
Mr. My final comment, Madam Chair, is I know we have another bill that we need to be getting to here this morning, but I think this is a valuable discussion, particularly leading up to that particular bill. Mr. Cocking, I think that when we talk about affordability, The two drivers right now on affecting affordability for people are the rising cost of property insurance, and number two is the rising cost of property taxes. If you go back and look historically over the last 40 years, that part of the pie has grown. And so when you talk about your qualifying guidelines to be able to, and Representative Hewitt knows this and being in the industry, that you get your PI, your principal and interest payment, and you have your taxes and insurance. And the more that that tax and insurance portion grows, the less principal and interest and or home that you're able to afford and to purchase. So whenever we take these matters in front of the committee, I think it's very important to look at not just the microcosmic thing that's in front of us, but the domino effect of what can happen on there when those costs end up going up in the way, again, of property taxes, which is not the purview of this committee, but insurance certainly is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I saw Mr. Brickwoody. Did you have it?
Okay. Madam Chair, in the interest of time, okay. I'm sure this will get talked about.
All right. Seeing no other member discussion, any final thoughts to the bill, Representative Elkins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, we had a really good discussion. It's a good bill. I urge you to vote yes. I'll renew my motion that we move this bill to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you very much. All those in favor of House File 4223 as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion
no.
prevails. Thank you, Representative Elkins. All right.
It's got to go to rules. Madam Chair.
It was to Ways and Means, right?
No. It'll go back to the front desk, and then it'll be sent to rules.
Right, but the motion is to Ways and Means.
The motion also.
The motion is Ways and Means, but it'll go to rules.
It goes to rules.
Madam Chair, yeah, okay. I think that Representative Davis is correct when he says whatever we say we're going to, it gets sidetracked and off-ramped to rules, and then rules will decide if it ultimately ends up going to Ways and Means at that point based on whether or not there's going to be a waiver on it. So we can send it to the moon if we want, but it's still going to rules.
Thank you. All right. Next up is Representative Duran, House File 4222. Welcome to the committee, Representative Duran. I will move that House File 4422 before us with the intent to lay the bill over. Good. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to proceed with your bill presentation. I do not see any amendments, so.
Oh, I do not have any amendments, and I'm ready to go. So thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak on House File 4422 today. This bill expands the use of appraisal process and property insurance. Under current law, this process is typically limited to disagreements involving fire and hail damage. House File 4422 would extend the same framework to all types of property insurance claims where there is a dispute over the cost of damages. Specifically, when an insurer and an insurance company cannot agree on the actual cash value or the amount of loss under the property insurance policy, either party may invoke the appraisal process. This process is designed to provide a fair and efficient path to resolution without immediate resorting to litigation. Under the appraisal framework, both the insured and the insurer select independent appraisers. These two appraisers then agree upon a neutral umpire. Each party is responsible for the cost of their own appraiser, and the cost of the umpire is shared equally. By expanding the process to all property insurance disputes, House File 4422 promotes consistency, transparency, and fairness. It ensures that the policyholder and the insurers alike have access to the structure, balance, method of resolving disagreements over loss evaluations. Thank you for your time and consideration. I will move on to the testifiers.
Thank you very much. First on the agenda is Peter Brickwoody, followed by Tim Johnson. Tim Johnson. Online.
Yep, I'm here.
Sounds good. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Well, thank you. My name is Tim Johnson. I'm a local attorney. I do construction and insurance law, and I sit on the board of advisors for the Contractors Association of Minnesota. This bill sort of codifies what had been the standard way of doing business in the state for many years. If you're not familiar, Minnesota has a standard fire policy, and that standard fire policy sets the minimum threshold of what needs to be in a policy to protect both insureds and insurers. That standard fire policy requires that the policies have an appraisal provision, which was just explained, and that insureds have 2 years from the date of loss to get their claim resolved. Historically, every carrier had followed that framework in all perils, which is why we haven't had this discussion yet. But recently, many carriers are limiting that only to hail and fire, which means if you have a wind, a water loss, a vandalism loss, any other kind of loss that you could anticipate, you don't have access to this alternative dispute resolution mechanism that allows carriers and their insureds to resolve these sort of disputes out of court. This provision also guarantees that all claims will have 2 years. That's really important. I don't know if Tom Berry is here from Beltrami. I hope he is. But that county is experiencing the exact effects of what this bill is designed to safeguard against. They had a major wind event, and that causes, at times, significant structural damage. These claims aren't getting resolved within a year. There's not enough complex and sophisticated contractors to serve all of those people. So the only remedy that those folks have to get their houses fixed is to sue within 1 year. So this bill saves a couple of things. One, it gives people more time. And, you know, in Minnesota, we only have a 5 or 6 month building season. 1 year to resolve a claim is almost impossible if there's any kind of dispute. In addition, that appraisal clause allows these things to be handled outside of court. It should be telling me sitting here as a lawyer, I make a lot more money if everything goes into court. That should not override, though, the public policy that should demand that we allow all of those losses to be resolved outside of court. We've had a lot of talk about affordability here today, and this is a major driver of affordability, both at the insurance company level and the policyholder level. If we have more time to resolve the loss and we're able to use this much cheaper, quick, and efficient method of resolving these losses, the insurance premiums won't be driven by litigation. The homeowners won't have to hire lawyers, you know, within 1 year of their loss if they can't get it resolved. The bill does what was already happening in Minnesota for years up until recently, so it's not a major change. And functionally, there should be no reason we treat a complex wind, water, or vandalism loss differently than we treat a fire loss. So this levels the playing field, both for the carriers and the homeowners. So it's a bill I hope you seriously consider, and that I hope makes its way through the system, because there's a lot of homeowners that are struggling right now in Beltrami, and we just had a big loss in Faribault. It's going to be the same thing if this doesn't get fixed. We shouldn't force our homeowners to litigate because we live in a state that it's hard to resolve a complex claim within a year. And with that, I'll answer any questions, or I'll cede my time.
Thank you very much. If you just want to stick around for questions on Zoom. Yes. Next up, Aaron Cocking, followed by Adam Axiv. Welcome back.
Chair Cagle, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Aaron Cocking, and I serve as President and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, here today to respectfully oppose House File 4422. This bill moves Minnesota in the wrong direction when it comes to helping homeowners. Late-reported claims hurt homeowners. Our public policy should focus on encouraging prompt reporting, timely investigation, and quick payment of claims. Instead, this bill expands the time frame in a way that will naturally lead to more delayed claims. When claims are reported long after a loss, it becomes significantly harder to determine what actually happened. Temporary repairs may have been made, additional weather events may have occurred, and normal wear and tear continues. All of this makes causation more difficult to establish and increases the likelihood of disputes and delays. Current law recognizes this reality by encouraging timely action, but this bill would move us away from that. Additionally, this bill risks further abuse of the appraisal process. Minnesota already has a strong policy favoring appraisal, and courts give significant deference to appraisal awards on both amount of loss and, in some cases, causation issues and policy interpretation. Expanding the time to bring suit will effectively expand the time to demand appraisal, increasing the likelihood that the process is overused. We are already seeing strains within the current framework, and this bill would only exacerbate those issues rather than fix them.
Finally, and most importantly, I think for policy consideration, this bill will raise premiums. I read some of the materials provided ahead of time by the proponents submitted to the committee who said this bill won't raise premiums. But crossing our fingers and wishing really, 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 really hard that it won't isn't actually a strategy and doesn't actually work. Price is based on risk, and expanding the time frame someone has to file a claim increases risk exposure. We have other concerns, but given the single minute I had for testimony, I'll stop there. Respectfully urge the committee to oppose House File 4422, and as you all know, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair.
Sorry, thank you. Go ahead with your testimony.
Chair Cagles, members of the House Commerce Committee, for the record, I'm Adam Axvig, President and CEO of the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutual Insurance Companies. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today in opposition to House File 4422. I will try to keep my comments within the one-minute window afforded to testifiers today. As indicated in the name of my association, my membership is entirely comprised of mutual or policyholder-owned insurance companies operating in Minnesota. My members have an obligation to their insurers to fairly pay legitimate claims per the terms of the contract that their policyholders enter into when they purchase their policy. While the claims process typically goes smoothly, we also understand that there are instances where policyholder expectations in terms of the policy are in dispute, which is why it is important for policyholders to work with the agents they trust and read and understand their policy, including the processes laid out to resolve such disputes, including the appraisal process. While I hear the individuals impacted by last summer's storm in Bemidji who have voiced frustration with the current process under state law, I would point out that there are options in the marketplace currently, including many of my members, who allow for appraisal on wind claims for a period of time after the date of loss. There are elements of the current appraisal system that frustrate our companies as well, and in the longstanding tradition of the Commerce Committee, I would welcome an opportunity to have a broader discussion with all the stakeholders between now and the next legislative session to negotiate a more comprehensive reform to the appraisal process that keeps premiums in check while preserving options in the marketplace and protecting consumers. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. Next up is Troy Johnson, followed by Josh Hansen. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Troy is not going to be able to make it today.
Okay. Not online. Josh Hansen?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Josh Hansen. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Bill 4422. This bill is about one simple thing, giving Minnesota homeowners a fair and accessible way to resolve disputes with their insurance company. When a homeowner files a claim, there's often a disagreement about the value of the loss, not whether damage occurred, but what it's worth. Appraisal has long been the most efficient and affordable way to resolve that dispute without forcing families into litigation. And that matters because most homeowners cannot afford to sue their insurance company. Appraisal is often the only realistic path for a working family to recover what they are owed and repair their home. In recent years, we've seen appraisal rates narrowed and timelines shortened. At the same time, claims have become more difficult to resolve and more disputes are arising over the value of losses. That combination has hit lower and middle income families the hardest, especially those with smaller claims where hiring an attorney or a public adjuster may not be economically feasible. You may hear from insurers that expanding appraisal rights will increase costs or raise premiums, but that argument deserves scrutiny. Appraisal does not create new losses. It resolves disagreements about losses that already exist. The limited data we do have shows that when claims are fully evaluated, whether through appraisal or other forms of dispute resolution, final settlements are often significantly higher than initial offers. That does not mean costs are being created. It means valuations are being corrected. So if expanding appraisal access leads to higher payouts, what that really tells us is that independent review changes outcomes. At the same time, premiums have already been rising significantly over the past several years, and carriers have continued to grow premium volume and maintain strong financial positions. So it is difficult to argue that giving homeowners a fair dispute resolution process is what is driving affordability challenges. This bill does not guarantee any particular outcome. It simply ensures there is a process, one that is faster, more efficient, and far more accessible than litigation. Without appraisal, disputes do not go away. They just become harder and more expensive for homeowners to pursue.
The bill restores balance. It ensures when there is a disagreement, both sides have a fair way to resolve it. I respectfully urge your support.
Thank you very much. Next up is John Carlson, followed by Doug Fuller. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Cagle and Chair O'Driscoll and members of the committee. My name is John Carlson. I'm a former state senator. I am a retired insurance agent, and I'm also a county commissioner in Beltrami County, where we had the direct goal in June 21st of last summer. I have a prearranged testimony, and it's in your packet. But after hearing the previous discussion on Representative Elkins' bill, House File 4223, I really enjoyed that discussion, because what it brought back to me as an insurance agent was how many claims my insurance company solved without any appraisal process, without any adjudication, and I think most insurance companies are fair. And so it was an industry that I made a living in, and so I'm not here to say anything bad against the insurance companies. And I worked with Adam Axvig and Aaron Cocking when I was in the state Senate, and they're honorable people, and they're doing their job really well. I appreciate what they do. But here's the point. Most of the claims that I had and most of the claims that most agents that I know have are settled fairly and quickly, and that's to a credit to the insurance industry. However, there are times, and most of those times are when there's a critical storm, a very bad storm in your area. And what happens is the insurance companies get overwhelmed by how many claims have to be processed, and so they have to resort to claims people from out of state, from other out of state, and they have to resort to third-party appraisers. They come in, they get paid, they're bing, bang, boom, and they're out. And the next thing you know, the insured is going, wait a minute, this isn't anywhere close to what my contractor told me the windows are going to cost. How do I get a fair shake? And this happens most often when we have a bad storm. Most of you have had a bad storm in your area, because Minnesota is associated with that in many areas. I would urge members to think about their own homeowner's policy. Think about, if you're an insured, think about your constituents, and think about the problems that they go through. If they're one of the few, but there are many, but there are few that get treated poorly, not because the insurance company wanted to do it, but because maybe an appraiser, an adjuster, was just in a hurry to get through that claim and get on to the next disaster. So I would urge you that this is not going to raise rates, because the only way it could raise rates is if the insurance companies are using their actuarial powers and factoring in the fact that they can fudge on their claims so that they don't have to pay everything that they owe. But that's not true. The insurance companies, I don't believe, do that. But I do believe that their appraisers and adjusters are human, and they're going to make mistakes. And rather than force an insured to have to go to the courts to try to get a fair settlement, and yes, they will have to pay a public appraiser, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20%. 20% is the most I've ever seen. 10% is probably more common. As an insurance agent, if I had to suggest to an insured that they do that, I would, but I wouldn't do that until we've exhausted everything through the insurance company, because I would have to advise them that, look, you're going to lose part of that of your claim if you go to a public adjuster. So the insurance agent that I worked with, from all companies that I worked across, I was actually the president of the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors for the state of Minnesota, and so I worked with many insurance agents across all companies, and I believe that for the most part, it's fair. All this does, and you've heard this many times, all this does is give the same process to all perils of the policy that they already have for fire and wind. It doesn't create any new money. The insurance companies aren't out any more money. And it's a very small fraction of the people that it will affect. And so the amount of money extra that an insurance company would have to pay out is very small compared to what is being portrayed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next up, Doug Filler. Sorry, I lost my place here. Followed by Ann Gorman. Online?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Douglas Fuller. I'm actually in Bemidji. Sorry, I forgot to take off my cruise ship background there. I apologize for that, but wouldn't it be nice to be on vacation again? Quick background on me. Again, my name is Douglas Fuller, a former state representative from 98 to 2004. So I've sat in your chairs and I'm enjoying the discussion back and forth. But really, I'm here in support of Representative Duran's bill. And to bring you a real-world example as to the storm that hit Bemidji last June 21st and why it's important for you to extend that one-year time frame for filing a claim or to settle claims. Because I'm getting ready, and I'm not going to name my insurance company so far. Things are going really well. Satisfied with how the discussions are going with the insurance company, but circumstances very soon in the next month are going to force me that if we aren't settled, I'm going to have to file suit just to keep my rights available to me so I don't lose those after June 21st. And I'll give you an example. In your packet, you should have two pictures of parts of my roof trusses. One picture is a distant picture of a roof truss, and the other one is a close-up picture where you can see the little nail bites of that gusset plate are no longer inside the wood. They pulled out from the windstorm. My house was literally shaking. We had 123 plus mile an hour winds, which is really category 3 hurricane force winds, unseen in Bemidji before. We had a storm in 2012 where we saw 80 to 85 mile an hour winds, and I can rest assured that 123 plus is a lot different than 85. And the damage we sustained, and the reason why I think it's important for you to hear about my circumstances is we had lots of tree damage, we had siding damage, windows blown out, but also during the claim process, we had our adjuster up on our roof, investigating the roof and the shingles, arguing with our contractor that there wasn't enough damage to the roof shingles to justify replacing them. Only to find out, and it was about late October, early November, where we went up into our attic with our contractor to investigate the insulation. Had it been blown around? Because that happens. Wind gets up in the soffits and blows your insulation everywhere. Where we had a structural engineer up there with them, and they found and took those exact pictures. So that was 4 months after the storm. And so our whole claim changed. Because now, through the process, we have determined all 26 of the trusses in our roof are no longer structurally sound. Matter of fact, our insurance company paid about $40,000 just to secure the trusses so they could handle a snow load over the winter. And now it has. We just had a foot of wet snow and they held up. Point being that we found that 4 months into the process and are still working on determining what the final cost is going to be to our claim. And it's very significant. Those of you that might not know construction, replacing trusses on a roof means that the whole floor underneath gets gutted. The flooring, the walls, that means the electric needs to be brought up to code, the plumbing needs to be brought up to code. The roof trusses now are more expensive and need to be brought up to code and changed. And it is a significant amount of money. And so we're still in that process, and we've been actively working on settling our claim, and it's just getting to the point where we're going to have to file suit pretty soon because we're running out of time. And that doesn't count to the repairs that have to happen. So somebody had mentioned that there aren't enough qualified contractors to handle some of these claims, and that's a very true factor. You take a town the size of Bemidji, and we have contractors coming from all over the state. There's not enough of them. Our contractors last summer coming out of spring were already booked solid, had their plates full for the whole summer, and then the storm hits, and they're all working overtime, double time, doing everything they can to help their fellow neighbors, and they can't absorb that kind of damage. So, and I'll stand for questions here in a second, but my point to you is consider taking that 1 year back to 2 years. But the other big point I want to get across to you is this idea of appraisal. We're not able to go to appraisal on our claim. And when I was in the legislature, and the legislature over the last 30 years has been trying to get cases out of the courts and trying to come up with dispute resolution methods other than just setting them into the court process so we need more judges, et cetera. I would highly encourage you to continue that trend and put the appraisal process back into effect giving both parties the opportunity to go to appraisal, because it is true that as soon as we go to attorneys and have to go to a lawsuit, that changes everything, and it's not good for either party in my mind. So thank you for listening. We are struggling up here, but all is doing well, and we just hope that for future storms, you guys can make it a little bit easier for folks in insurance companies to get along. Madam Chair, I'll answer any questions, or I'll be here if you need me.
Thank you very much. Next up is Ann Gorman, followed by Audrey Thayer. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Ann Gorman. I am a resident of Beltrami County, living in Bemidji, Minnesota. I am here to support the Bill 4422. I am one of the residents who was affected by the June storm. I reported my incident within 24 hours, and I said it was a thunderstorm with wind, hail, and water damage. It got entered into the system as wind damage. And I am still in the process of doing my repairs. There were a number of things that were delayed, and there are two areas that have not been completely looked at and still may have additional damage because we were unable to demo our deck and front stairs to assess the damage underneath them because of the delays in coverage. There were a number of times that I considered enacting my appraisal clause during my claim, and it should always be available to residents as a homeowner, homeowners as an option when there's disputes in insurance coverage. I've had three site visits. The first two were from third-party appraisers on June 29th and August 14th. And the first one only had $40,000 worth of coverage and only covered 50% of my roof. That appraiser showed up, the assessor showed up thinking he knew where the storm damage was going to be because he read a report. And in his report, it said there was no hail damage. So he refused to acknowledge any of the hail damage that was obvious on my roof. He also told me I was unable to have my contractor available to point out damage and that assured me that any additional damage that we saw could be submitted through supplemental claims and subcontractor and subcontractor bids with pictures. So despite him with these reassurances, my desk adjuster also said that supplementals was going to be available to me. And all of the pictures and subcontractor bids that we submitted were pretty much ignored. So I kept on asking questions and how I was supposed to get myself to pre-loss conditions without the proper coverage. I asked and I asked and I asked. And finally, they did send in that second adjuster who did document and say that there was hail damage on the roof and admitted that 100% of my fence and 100% of my deck and my front stairs were all damage from the storm, but still did not provide me the coverage needed for the subcontractor bids for those items. So I kept on asking how I was supposed to get to my pre-loss conditions and providing additional documentation through pictures, and that's when the third site inspection happened, and that was with my insurance company's assessor, and finally started addressing the subcontractor bids that I had submitted in the first place. So I finally have, the initial was $40,000 and my current coverage is $132,000. So obviously they've admitted that there was damage. And the other issue that came up was during my roof, my contractor tore it off and discovered that there were three layers of roofing felt and that none of the previous roofs had taken off the step flashing
Ms.
at
Gorman?
The area where the roof and the siding meet.
We have very little time. Can I ask you to wrap up, please?
Sure.
I'm sorry.
They told my contractor not to follow building code. My insurance company told my contractor not to follow that building code to do the roof in the right way. And it was only after I filed a complaint with the commission, the Commerce Department here, and also got the city, my contractor reached out to the city inspector to say that he was supposed to follow the building code as it was described in the code. That was the only time that they decided, that was immediately after those two things happened is when they decided to cover the coverage for those building code. They called it upgrades, but I call it following the building code that was already in place.
Thank you.
And so because of these items, these reasons, and my experience, I would support this bill because that 1 year timeline is not sufficient, and I have been struggling to get my damages covered.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Aubrey Thayer, followed by Carl Swanson and Kurt Anderson. We have 5 minutes left, so I'm going to ask you, please keep it short. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Thayer.
Hello, and welcome to you all to hear the stories of the Great North. I am here talking about the city of Bemidji and the June 21st, 2025 storm. And I, as any city council member, was out in community and dealing with the immense amount of damage we had in the city of Bemidji. And it was appalling. And I live in an area of that was part of the heartbeat of the storm. And I also took many calls from the marginalized community of our retirees, people who are working, who have a limited income, what they were to do with their insurance companies. I'm testifying today as a policyholder because I was in a damage of about $50,000 and still in a disagreement and dispute with our insurance company in regards to our roof. So the codes clearly said, our city codes, that a percentage of the roof, if damaged, should be repaired completely. And the roof was, I bought the home 4 years ago, and the home had a roof of about 14 years. And what happened out of this was they denied that roof. And we have had 4 winters of below zero, 4 months of below zero weather up here. So my siding, which has been damaged on all 4 sides of the house, are in question. So I am supportive of 4422, but it's a 1 year period I'd like that expanded because we are getting close to the 1 year period. I was disappointed in adjusters. They were not unbiased. They had opinions. They were not informed. My adjuster came out of Kentucky and was hired 4 days prior. I never got on the roof. And when you look at their responsibilities, I'm here testifying, say it was not okay because my story is like many others in the city. And we are still sitting with tarps on our roofs, and we're still sitting with trees in our lawn, close to a year later. So I don't want to have to take it to litigation. I would like to continue to resolve the disputes with my insurance company, but I'm coming up against that time frame. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Next up, Carl Swanson, followed by Kurt Anderson. So if you could please just proceed with the testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you. Very quickly, please.
Okay, I'm Carl Swanson. I'm a resident of Beltrami County. My home and property was one of the hardest hit in the area. We got the gold star on the state map of the storm damage. I struggled also getting an appraiser. Once about the third guy that was supposed to come finally came, did a very cursory exam. I showed him written estimates of $95,000 in what was considered covered by my policy. According to the insurance company, I had verbal quotes of over $150,000. 2 days later, he responded with a phone call offering me $10,000 to settle. I said, that's not acceptable. He then, 2 days after that, with no further discussion, sends me a check for $20,000 and closed my claim.
Mr. Swanson, we're going to, we still have a couple more people, so do you mind if we move on?
I can wrap real quick. I ended up going the public adjuster route, and it was very beneficial, and it worked. And I think there's a real problem in the insurance industry with how they are handling the adjusting of these storms and their consumers.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kurt Anderson. I'm a public adjuster who was operating in Bemidji after the storm. About half of the homes I inspected
while I was up there had damage like Doug Fuller's, where it was hidden in the attic and there was damage to the trusses, and none of them knew. One of my clients asked their insurance adjuster to go up into the attic to inspect it, and they were declined because he believed that the storm could not have damaged the trusses without having visual, without being able to see it from the outside. Many of these adjusters on these claims were from across the country and repeatedly lacked local knowledge and construction expertise. We constantly had to explain Minnesota building codes and talk about complex trade coordination. My colleague and I went to Bemidji after hearing stories like the ones you've heard today, but after learning that appraisal wasn't possible with certain companies, we realized that these people had no recourse. There was no path forward. Litigation costs tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars on claims like these and can take years. Meanwhile, you're paying a second mortgage or draining your retirement savings to get by. And appraisal costs like $3,000 and takes an afternoon. This offering appraisal for all covered apparels, all covered perils in Minnesota has been industry standard for decades. Failing to pass this bill would effectively endorse the removal of that standard, and framing it as a sudden increase in cost to insurance companies increasing premiums is just not accurate.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Brookwood, real quick, or just here to answer any questions?
Madam Chair, quickly, a couple of things. Again, Peter Brickwitty from the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm here to express the department's support for House Bill 4422, and I just want to thank our neighbors from Beltrami County and Bemidji for telling their stories, particularly as so much of the community remains in recovery from the storm last year. As was mentioned earlier, this was a topic that was talked about at the legislative task force over the interim, and we have three members of the task force give three different interpretations of what the law currently is in Minnesota. And so we view this as a technical clarification so that we have consistency in the law for every policyholder, regardless of what type of claim that they're having and what peril caused that claim. Just a couple of things, Madam Chair, quickly. I agree with Mr. Cocking. We want prompt reporting, adjustment and payment of claims. Totally agree with that. If that happens, we don't have consumers ending up in alternative dispute resolution or going to litigation. And I think that if the concern about this is that somehow there would be an increase in costs, I think that argument doesn't make sense to the department because, A, we don't see insurers making filings that attribute actuarial costs to these types of alternative dispute resolution mechanisms. And if the dispute is about the process, then I think we'd be certainly willing to work on additional changes. But confusion in the marketplace is not good for anybody, consumers and companies alike, and that's why this clarification would be useful.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will not share any comments given the time that we have left, but I will let you know that we will not be meeting tomorrow as a committee. I know we posted that there may be additional business. That was a safety net. If you feel like you need to be here tomorrow morning, the room may be open at 8:15, but I will not be here.
Members, I just really want to, I wish we had more time for thank yous and all that, but everybody, it's been an honor to work with you guys this year. We've done some really, really good work. I think we have the most bills on the general register. And so I thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. This has been a really good working relationship and I think a model for how the legislature should work. Staff are instructed to make any technical corrections to the minutes. And so with that, members, this bill is House File 4422 will be laid over, and we are adjourned.